If you don't have an outline yet, back in the back there are some outlines of Acts 18. There's also some old ones from Acts 17. And tonight we're going to finish the second missionary journey. So we've set off since Acts 13, we've set off on two missionary journeys. So we'll finish a second one and then we'll start a third one tonight. At least that's the intent. And so if you remember from Acts chapter 16 and 17, we have been to Macedonia, which was Philippi. Then we went to Thessalonica and Berea. And then we just finished up the last chapter in Athens. And that's in the province of Achaia, I think is how you pronounce it. So if you look on your Acts 18 outline at the very left-hand side green, that's Achaia. Now, Paul, and we're going to do a couple things tonight where we're going to reference Achaia, but Paul references multiple times in the letters that he's going to write, and we're going to try to pinpoint some of the times that he wrote these letters. So there's going to be a little connect the dots here, but a lot of times he'll say, you know, greet this brother, he was the first fruits of the province of Achaia. So that means nothing to us until now, because now we look at the map and in Achaia, we see Athens and Corinth. And so knowing that he had invested so much in Corinth, then we begin to make sense of, it doesn't tell us in Acts the name of a lot of the people that were saved. But in some of the other books, it tells us he was one of the first fruits of Achaia. So it's a safe assumption, I think, to think it's either Athens or Corinth. But it seems like he's saying is the first time that I went through Achaia, that province, this brother was saved during that trip. And so they were there from the very beginning. And so we'll kind of look at that a little bit tonight, but we're going to, I find it fascinating kind of when Paul wrote some of these letters, the connection with some of the letters as well as with the travels. And so we'll do some of that tonight as well. So let's start Acts 18 verses 1 through 4. To meet two people who you've likely heard about before. It says, after these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because that Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome, and came unto them. And because he was of the same craft, he abode with them and wrought, and for by their occupation they were tent makers. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. And so whoever's keeping track, I know Megan's one of them, keeping track of our times that he's going to the synagogue. So here's another occasion. He enters into a city. He goes to a synagogue. We meet Aquila and Priscilla. Now these names are going to pop up a number of places. And notice it says there that they began, or they were first in Rome. And then the emperor, Claudius, who is the emperor just before Nero. Nero's kind of the famous one that burned all the city of Rome, and a lot of the persecution started under Nero. So Claudius is right before him, and we see a little bit of signs of religious persecution here. He's forcing all the Jews that live in Rome, you have to leave. And so they had left Aquila and Priscilla, and they had traveled to Corinth. They were tent makers. Now, remember, a tent maker then is different than a tent maker now. A tent maker then was a much more substantive or important occupation because it wasn't uncommon. It's not like there were tons of hotels, right? You didn't have your Holiday Inn when you stopped city to city. A lot of times, especially if you were a poor sort, you would pack a tent and you would travel in that tent. Of course, people who lived out on the pasture or in more rural areas, that was a more common, I don't want to say semi-permanent, right? But a common place they lived. So Paul, Aquila, and Priscilla are working, but I want to emphasize that they're working an occupation that would have been a substantive occupation of the time. It was one that was going to keep them plenty busy working whenever they needed to work. Now, I want to point out a few things about Aquila and Priscilla. And so if you'll go ahead and turn to these scriptures, one's in 1 Corinthians 16 and one's in Romans 16. There's three non-Acts locations where Aquila's and Priscilla's name are brought up. And so essentially what I think is a safe assumption to learn is we know from here, they're in Rome. That's their home or semi-home. They had been expelled. So they travel down to Corinth. Paul meets them. They become fellow workers in sharing the gospel. And they're going to be a prominent part, especially as we get to the end of this chapter. They're a prominent part of teaching and instructing some young Christians. They're going to set out here in this chapter. They're going to leave Corinth. And when they do, they're going to travel with Paul. And it doesn't seem like they have a destination. They've just met up with him as a fellow believer. They're behind what he's doing. They don't have a settled home anymore. So they just begin to travel with him. It seems like, the way the writer of Acts tells us, he's setting his way. He's heading back towards Antioch, the church that he was sent out from. So he's trying to complete his full journey. He's going to stay in Corinth, and we'll learn more about this here in a few moments, for 18 months. So this was not a short mission trip. He's here for 18 months, teaching the people here after they become believers. Then he leaves, and if you'll notice on the map, he goes to Ephesus, right? So that's the place in the pink. And this is, of course, Asia Minor, where he had been previously forbidden from going at the beginning of this trip. Now, it makes you wonder if one of the reasons why he was prevented from going there was because when he finally makes his way around there, now he's got two helpers with him, Aquila and Priscilla. They're going to stay in Ephesus. He's going to keep going. And part of what they're going to do is further the gospel message in Ephesus. And so, obviously, that's me reading into it some. You can come to your own conclusions, but that at least begs the question whether that was the case or not. So, while he's in Ephesus, let me see here what else I was wanting to say. So, if you look at 1 Corinthians 16, and we'll just look at verse 19. It says, "The churches of Asia salute you." Now, Aquila and Priscilla salute you much in the Lord with the church that is in their house. So, Paul is writing here. This is his third missionary journey. Okay? So, if you'll look on the right side, and I'm trying not to confuse you here. If you look at Antioch, where he started from, in the yellow, in Syria. Everybody look at that. On his third missionary journey, he's going to do the same thing he did before, traveling through Galatia. This will be the fourth time he goes to those churches. But this time, our red arrow on the map you have in front of you, you remember he was told to avoid Asia Minor. On his third journey, he leaves Galatia and he goes straight to Ephesus, which would make sense directionally. That was likely his plan on the second journey. But the Holy Spirit stopped him from doing that, in the sense of it just makes sense geographically. On this third journey, when he's in Ephesus, he is writing 1 Corinthians. Clear as mud, right? On the next chapter, I'll have a map that looks like this, but it's of his third journey, right? So he's going to be in Ephesus. He's going to write the letter to 1 Corinthians to the Corinthians. It is here where he is at Ephesus and he's writing to the church at Corinth and he's saying, "Hey, just to let you know, you met Aquila and Priscilla. That's where I met them when I was with you. I preached the gospel. People got saved. We left and came to Ephesus. I left them here in Ephesus. Then I went all the way back to Antioch. I went, did some things in Jerusalem. I went up to Galatia on my third journey. And now I'm back at Ephesus. And I'm here with Aquila and Priscilla now. They greet you." Right? So, again, I'm just trying to make some of the connections timeline-wise that this third missionary journey that we'll get to in the next chapter, when he's in Ephesus, he's writing to them at Corinth, but we're introduced to them now on the second journey, Aquila and Priscilla. So that's one reference of Aquila and Priscilla. If you look at Romans 16, we'll get another reference of Aquila and Priscilla. Now, this is the book of Romans, so it's written to the believers in Rome, where they were originally from, but they were forced to leave after Claudius expelled them. Before Romans is written, Claudius dies, and that law or that expulsion is eliminated. So now Jews can live in Rome. So, what would you do if you had to leave somewhere for 3 or 4 years and then you're permitted to go back, you would probably go back, right? That's just a that's what they do. They travel from Ephesus back to Rome. While they're in Rome, Paul just says, "Greet Priscilla and Aquila, my helpers in Christ Jesus, who have for my life laid down their own necks, unto whom not only I give thanks, but also all the churches of the Gentiles." But keep reading. "Likewise, greet the church that is in their house." So they have a church in their house. They're in Rome. "Salute my well-beloved." Anybody want to take a shot at that name? Epaphroditus, we'll go with. "Who is the first fruits of Achaia unto Christ." Okay, so the first time that Paul went through Achaia. Now if we look at our map right here in the green, this is right now. He's in Achaia at this moment in Acts 18. He's saying this man, Epaphroditus, this is when he gets saved. So we know he's been saved here. And that could have been Athens. It could have been Corinth. We don't know exactly, but this is definitely a reference to that. So, and then I think there might have been one more. I want to look real quick here, make sure I'm not lying to you. Anybody got any comments or questions you want to ask? Again, these things are just fascinating to me, that you can kind of start pinpointing times, places, people. And then the last one is 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 19. And it's just the last reference we have to Priscilla and Aquila. It says, "Salute Priscilla and Aquila in the household of Onesiphorus, I guess. So that's the last. And if I remember correctly, Paul is writing, what was it, 2 Timothy from, I don't remember where he's writing it, from Ephesus maybe. Any comments or questions? I'm just kind of wanting to give you some context on Aquila and Priscilla. So it seems like the two places they're going are permanently residents. Rome, Ephesus, their permanent residency. But Paul meets them in Corinth. So the church at Corinth is familiar with them. All right. Any thoughts, comments? Anybody? So evidently, according to the book of Romans, somehow they risked their lives. Now, that's not surprising, since Nero was a horrible persecutor of Christians. Hopefully you know a little bit about that. He used to put Christians up all throughout the streets of Rome, light them on fire as candlelight. So if they're living in Rome and they're helping Paul, then they're definitely at risk. And then notice that their help was so broadly impactful that he says, not only did they help me, they helped all the Gentile churches, which would have been, everywhere that he's been on these second journeys are full of Gentiles. From Galatia, we know from reading the book of Galatians that there are Gentiles there, and everywhere else, there's Gentiles in all those churches. And so Paul is thankful for whatever they are doing in that regard. So two notable people, but that's not even all they're going to do in this chapter. They're going to also do some other things that are going to be notable to us. So let's see here. So we just point out, and we'll go to page 2 of our outline, but we just point out again that Paul travels to the Jewish synagogue in verse 4, and he preaches to the Jews and the Greeks. And so let's go ahead and read Acts 18, 5 through 17. And then we're going to kind of bounce back and forth here from page 1 to page 2 to point something out. It says this: "And when Silas and Timotheus were come from Macedonia, Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus was Christ." Now notice how that's phrased right there. What he's contending to these people is that Jesus is the Messiah. "And when they opposed themselves and blasphemed, he shook his raiment and said unto them, Your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean. From henceforth I will go unto the Gentiles. And he departed thence and entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one that worshipped God, whose house joined hard to the synagogue. And Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his house. I want to pause there for a moment. Now think about the significance of that. If I told you any church in Bowling Green that I went to that church, that you went to that church, and their pastor converted, that's a really big deal. That somebody that steeped in the religion would then become a convert of that. And so, as a result, so I think that whole sentence is easily connected. If I converted to another religion, you all might take second thought. Man, the guy that's been teaching us for a few years is now all of a sudden converting. Maybe there is something to that. Let's at least give audience, more serious audience to that. And so it says in the next point, and many of the Corinthians hearing believed and were baptized. Then spake the Lord to Paul in the night by a vision. Be not afraid, but speak, and hold not thy peace. For I am with thee, and no man shall set on thee to hurt thee. For I have much people in this city. And he continued there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. So to me, this also gives us a different... when you go through 1 Corinthians and you read it, realize that Paul was acquainted enough with these people that he was there 18 months. So you would get very familiar with these people. Right? Whereas when he was in Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, it doesn't tell us exactly how long he's there. Some of the places he wasn't there super long. But when he's writing 1 Corinthians and he gets into such detail, is that possibly one of the reasons why the letter is so long? He knows a lot about the people. He knows their practices well. He knows the way the city functions. He's seen the paganism in the city. He's seen the temptations that they had undergone. And so it makes sense to me that he would write such a lengthy thing. But notice there that God gives him this encouragement. He's starting to see these converts. Based upon Paul's experience this far, as soon as thought leaders in a city get converted, what happens next? People seek to kill him. And so perhaps he has this fear. To me, I feel like we can surmise that by just the fact that God, after all those experiences on the first and second journey where he's been beaten, left for dead, now he's doing the same thing, the same pattern followed, good results are coming. He might be tempted to prematurely leave. He's human flesh just like all of us. And God says, don't worry. I want you to stay. There's a lot of people in the city that are believers, more than what you can see at the moment. Nobody's going to hurt you. And so it tells us that he decides to stay for another 18 months. And then I want to put the stress where I feel like we've perhaps overemphasized. What did he do in that year and a half time? He did not hold revivals. Right? I was just talking to a missionary today. They have a little group that's there. And I just asked, why are you assuming you just hold revival next? Why is that the assumption? I'm not saying you shouldn't. The Lord's in it. That's what you need to do. Have you ever considered that we're now seeing this common thread through Acts that Paul is saying we have this community of believers. It's going to be much more effective for every member of that church to sufficiently be equipped with the ability to be a missionary themselves in their community than having one person. And if that one person leaves, there's no missionary efforts anymore. And that's what God is looking to do with us, right? It's the same thing. You can't depend on your Sunday school teacher, your deacons, your pastor to be the evangelist. That's why, you know, I've always tried to make a distinction. There's a difference in inviting somebody to church and evangelizing. They are not one and the same. Right? Inviting somebody to church is a great thing. To me, that's a secondary if I had to choose between the two. I'd rather you, who knows the person, who's developed the trust and the relationship with the person, you're going to likely be more effective reaching the heart of that person than them walking in with 100 strangers and some guy yelling at them that they don't even know. Right? So to me, this pattern is something that is just crystal clear in Acts. When there's a group of young believers that have just converted, teach them. And Paul is devoted enough to it that despite traveling to every city that he's going to, and there's many people who get saved. So he's on this journey, he's been all these places, and everywhere he goes, there are people that get saved. The human logic and pragmatism would say, well, then let's hurry to another city and let's preach to those people that they might get saved. But Paul doesn't do that. Because the end that Paul is looking for is the same thing we are in the Great Commission. It's the same thing that exists in Acts chapter 1. We do want to see people get converted, but then we want to see them get baptized to start a local congregation and be made disciples. That is the picture that Acts is painting for us. That's the goal. Preach that people are saved, baptize them, and then disciple them. Not hold a revival and let's just move on. That's only fulfilling a part of the commandment of God. And I can't help but point out, as he's there, from a human vantage point, he is sacrificing a great deal. 18 months of his time. And he's got a limited lifespan. We know this. But that's how important that it is. In verse 12, it says this, and when Gallio was the deputy of Achaia, now, I'm not going to get too deep off into the history here, but Gallio is actually a significant historical figure. He's a brother to the tutor of Nero. So Gallio was on the Roman Senate. He was a Roman senator, which was one of very few, so he has a lot of political power. He's brother, tutored Nero at a young age, and then becomes an advisor to Nero when he becomes the emperor of Rome. And so this isn't just a passive person that's unimportant. This is a significant person. But this significant Roman man, deputy, is pretty unconcerned with Paul. And so in verse 13, or let's see here, verse 12, and when Gallio was the deputy of Achaia, the Jews made insurrection with one accord against Paul and brought him to the judgment seat. So they brought him to the court, saying, this fellow persuadeth men to worship God contrary to the law. And when Paul was now about to open his mouth, Gallio said unto the Jews, if it were a matter of wrong or wicked lewdness, O ye Jews, reason would that I should bear with you. But if it be a question of words and names and of your law, look ye to it, for I will be no judge of such matters. And he drave them, from the judgment seat. Then all the Greeks took Sosthenes, the chief ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat. And Gallio cared for none of these things. All right, so notice a few things going on here. First of all, verse 8, Crispus. Actually, let me back up even further than that. Let me see here. I want to make sure I get the right verse. All right, so in verses 1 through 4, on the first page, it seems to me, and you all can tell me if you think this is true from the reading, Paul meets Aquila and Priscilla through his occupation, being a tent maker, right? And because he was the same craft, he abode with them and worked, for by their occupation they were tent makers. That's that. Now, if you look at verse 5, but in our first bullet point, if you look at the NASB, it's worded a little different. It says, but when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word. There's a change here. He was working. Then Silas and Timothy get there. He stops working and he's given himself completely to the word. Now here's a simple logical question. Where did the money come from? Because there's a change in what he's doing. Where did the money come from suddenly for him to not have to devote himself to working to now where he can just preach the gospel full time? Well, the scriptures tell us that, all right? If you look, and you can just look on the bottom of page 2, I've got two quotes, one from Corinthians and one from Philippians. This is his writing the book of 2 Corinthians. Now, as irony has it, it's not irony, it's providence. When he writes 2 Corinthians, he's in Philippi on his third journey. Okay, we'll get into that next week. And this is what he's writing to the Corinthians. I robbed other churches, taking wages of them to do you service. So he's talking about where he's at right now in Acts. And he was in Corinth, and he says, I robbed other churches so that I could minister to you. And when I was present with you and wanted, that means he had no money. He was in want. I was chargeable to no man for that which was lacking to me, the brethren which came from Macedonia supplied. Who were the brethren that came from Macedonia? Silas and Timothy. That's what we just read in Acts 18. You following me? Clear as mud. All right. Whenever Timothy and Silas get there, they gave the offering from the Macedonians to the Apostle Paul. And in all things, I have kept myself from being burdensome unto you, and so will I keep myself. So evidently, now Paul writes this in a discussion about ministers being full-time in the gospel. That's the subject of 2 Corinthians chapter 11, that he who preaches the gospel should live of the gospel. But he's saying, evidently he thought, while I'm preaching to you, if I required you to support me full-time, this would be a stumbling block to you. You would think that I was after money. So I'm not going to do that. But there were more mature Christians in Macedonia who realized that the gospel was so important, even if it was not directly benefiting them, that they wanted to see Paul given to that full time, so they deprived themselves. They sent him money so that he could do that. And I would say would look very similar or ought to us supporting missionaries. Right? If we support missionaries throughout the world, we don't see the direct spiritual results in our church of people being saved. But to a mature Christian that realizes that God's desire is to have be glorified among all nations and all people in the world, that of course I would support those things so that the gospel can go out. So 2 Corinthians 11 is one example. The other one, Paul is commending the church in Philippi. He says this in Philippians 4, 15 through 17. Now you Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, so we've read that, the beginning of the gospel when I left Macedonia. We've already read over that in Acts 16, 17. That's when he was in Macedonia. No church communicated with me as concerning giving and receiving, but ye only. So none of the churches in Galatia, nobody helped me financially, but you did. For even in Thessalonica, you sent once and again unto my necessity. So right after he leaves Philippi, he goes to Thessalonica, right? Not only did they support him once, but twice, so that he could focus on preaching the gospel. And look at what the result was. Not because I desire a gift, but I desire fruit that may abound to your account. So now he's getting to the spiritual ramifications of them supporting the work. That there are spiritual blessings that God blesses for people who do that. Right? And that's, you can read that for yourself. So, I feel like I'm jumping all over tonight, but I'm trying to get, I guess if there's one conclusion you can take away, it's that these things that are said in different places can be traced back to Paul's journeys. We can find the direct references a lot of times of where these things are occurring at. Right? And to me, these are some good examples of that. Somebody have a comment or a question you want to ask?
Do you think that Gallio didn't have as much respect for the Jews because they were out of favor in Rome? Because he didn't, he said, you know, if it were wrong, I'd listen to you. But he didn't mind the Greeks beating them up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I take it as an indifference. He just doesn't care. I don't want this to become an official thing because I don't care. But if you beat them up, I don't really care either. Just don't cause me trouble. Whether that was because the Jews were out of standing in Rome, I don't know.
Yeah, it was likely with what they did with Jesus. They were constantly trying to use the government to do their bidding.
Mm-hmm. Which clearly seems like what they're doing here is they're just trying to manipulate the law after he's been there for 18 months to get him out of there. Now, again, I have to point this out about what Paul is doing here, and this is a sad thing, and this is a something that I think as Christians we have to mourn and think about with sobriety, and that is Paul is preaching to the Jews, and they keep rejecting and rejecting and rejecting, and he says, your blood is upon your own hands. I'm going to the Gentiles, and I'm going to preach. And the direction of my interest is transferred. Now, that can be done in spite, and we've talked about this before. You can do that in spite, or you can do that out of necessity. I think Paul's is obvious here. These people, much like the people we studied in John, were determined to reject. Much like the people in the first half of Acts. They kept hearing, they kept hearing, they kept rejecting, they kept rejecting. And I'll tell you, when this truth finally seeped its way into my heart to the depth necessary, it was very freeing. And I don't mean that mean or vindictively. It's just been the last few months where this truth has really settled in my heart that there is a sense to which we are not called to endlessly expend our resources trying to convince people who are determined to reject. There comes a time where we have to transfer our resources to others who may want the gospel. And this is just, to me, another example of many that we've seen so far through John and Acts. But this may be the most pronounced, where he kind of levies a warning, a judgment. Your blood is on you. And I think this obviously settles as a good reference. He's speaking to Jews. So what is that reference to? Your blood be upon your own hands. In Ezekiel, right? The watchman. This is a reference. I've been a watchman for you. Remember, the whole watchman's idea is that if the watchman doesn't warn, their blood is upon our hands. But if he does and they reject, their blood is upon their hands. And so he's making this analogy that a Jew would have really understood. And it should have been a sobering truth couched in this Old Testament story. You're on you. I'm going to the Gentiles, which would have been, again, to them, just an unthinkable thing to do. Now, what's interesting about the people that are converted is, so Crispus, if you'll look real quickly in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, that's one of the people. So he was the original leader of the synagogues. And then you'll notice that Sosthenes, the man who is beaten, he's the second leader of the synagogue. So it seems like what happens is Crispus converts. And just like if I left here and converted to a different religion, you would elect a new pastor, right? So now they have a new synagogue leader. His name is Sosthenes. Paul steals both of them, right? Crispus first. And if you look in verses 14 through 17, this man is one of the men that Paul baptized, one of the few in Corinth that Paul baptizes. Look at verse 14. I thank God that I baptized none of you but Crispus and Gaius. And he alludes to a couple others. So it makes you wonder if Paul here is, I don't want to say making a point by being willing to be. I would think you've got two men that are with you. You're the senior man. You've just been a vessel to help convert a leader in the community. God already had to give you reassurance that nobody's going to persecute you after this. So Paul's wanting to take the bullet himself. Well, if I baptize this man, it could cause a lot of problems. We might be, I'm just going to do it. I don't want Silas and Timothy. And again, this is just my conjecture here. I'm going to do it. I'm going to baptize him. He only baptizes a few in Corinth, but Crispus happens to be one of them. Now, if you look at verse 1 of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul, called to be an apostle of Jesus Christ through the will of God, and Sosthenes, our brother. So this is the second man who becomes the chief ruler of the synagogue, is with Paul while he's writing to the Corinthians. So we see these two men emerge once again. And I think, you know, that would have held a lot of sway when you're writing to the Corinthians, especially if it's coming as a rebuke. Like, 1 Corinthians is just one big rebuke. And so it may be easy for them to say, well, you're just an outsider. You don't know us. You haven't lived with us. But I'm writing it from me and who you used to go to the synagogue with and then got converted with. We're writing this to you. Right? And so, again, my conjecture here, but I think it's safe. He's writing with Sosthenes to perhaps give a little bit more validity in the Corinthians' minds to what he's saying here. But again, that's just my thoughts here. They go to this church that's next to, or they go preaching in Justice, a man whose house was attached to the Jewish synagogue in Corinth. Let's see here if there's anything else. I think I've all I got for this section. Anybody got a comment or a question I'm going to ask? A lot of information at you tonight. All right, so let's look at Acts. So page 4, Acts 18, 18 through 23. So he's there for 18 months. And Paul, after this, tarried there yet a good while and then took his leave of the brethren. I think I skipped a part, didn't I? No, I didn't. Okay. And sailed thence into Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila, having shorn his head in Centuria, for he had a vow. And he came to Ephesus and left them there. That's Aquila and Priscilla. But he himself entered into the synagogue. So that's another time where he goes to the synagogue. And reasoned with the Jews. When they desired him to tarry a long time with them, he consented not, but bade them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep this feast that cometh in Jerusalem, but I will return again unto you if God will. And he sailed from Ephesus, and when he had landed at Caesarea and gone up and saluted the church, he went down to Antioch. And after he had spent some time there, he departed and went over all the country of Galatia and Phrygia in order, strengthening all the disciples. All right, so it tells us Paul stays in Corinth for a good while. Set sail along with Aquila and Priscilla. They're headed to Syria, where the province where Jerusalem is located. But on his way, he stops in Ephesus, the place he had been forbidden from going before, where he first enters the Jewish synagogue. What time are we at that it mentions that he goes in the synagogue this many times? Eight times. So this is eight different places he's gone, or eight different times he's gone to the Jewish synagogue first. And then rather go on to Syria, Aquila and Priscilla stay in Ephesus as God has an important work for them to do shortly. So they're going to be put to use in Ephesus in a great way here in a moment. Now, it points out something that doesn't give us any commentary on, and maybe some of you would study this a little more. I didn't really dive deep into this rabbit hole, but the scriptures note that Paul cut his hair as he had previously committed himself to a vow of some sort. So, of course, the one that comes to mind is probably the Nazarite vow, where they wouldn't cut their hair and eat certain foods and drink wine and do these things. It's what most, I think, assume. I don't remember that there is a specific time in the New Testament where it says John the Baptist was, it doesn't say directly, I don't think, that he took a Nazarite vow, but we know he was devoted unto that end, it seems like. I think Zacharias and Elizabeth, you know, I think it was the angel, I think Gabriel tells him, you know, that he's going to basically be under a vow. Anybody know anything about these vows in the New Testament? Anybody ever study these? In light of people today sometimes deciding or discussing whether fasting is appropriate, I just find it interesting that here they've committed themselves to these vows that entail much more than just fasting. You wouldn't cut your hair, wouldn't drink, eat certain things. So I don't know. I just thought it was a fascinating thing to point out. But it takes note that Paul cuts his hair. It probably means something to somebody, but I don't know enough for it to mean something to me. So, but he does cut his hair. And he goes to the Jewish synagogue, he starts preaching, and they ask him to stay longer, which is kind of an interesting thing that they do here. Now, we're going to learn later in the book of Acts that the church at Ephesus becomes a very pillar-strong church with a lot of elders there. And we'll see that here in a few chapters. But he says that he's got to go back. He wants to make it back for a Jewish feast in Jerusalem. Again, as we talked about in John, there's three important ones. He was likely wanting to go back to preach. Also, there's tons of believers there now. He wants to make it back there. And then notice one to point out when he's in Ephesus, he says, if God wills, I'll be back. So again, I've tried to kind of make a dent in this idea that, you know, walking by faith is I know exactly where I'm going for the next 10 years because I'm a super Christian. I mean, Paul just says, like, listen, this is as far as I can go with you. If God wills, I'll be back. If not, I won't. And that seems to run really close in line with how God leads us, is that there's a lot of uncertainty from our angle. And then verse 23, so he goes back to Jerusalem, and then he makes his way up to Antioch, and that completes the second missionary journey. So look at verse 22, it says, and when he landed at Caesarea and gone up and saluted the church, he went down to Antioch. Should say went up, right, because it's north, but you know what he means. He goes to Antioch, right? Maybe he's saying down the mountain. I don't know. So he goes to Antioch. He completes the second missionary journey. Then it tells us he stays there for a little while. That's what it says in verse 23. Spent some time there. Some people I read, and I don't know why they say this, they said it was about a year. They didn't give any proof text, but that's just what they guessed, I guess. And then he sets out on his third missionary journey here. And then it's going to pause our narrative with Paul. And it's going to come to Aquila and Priscilla and to somebody else. So notice here, Paul, on his third missionary journey, it begins, he goes to Galatia and Phrygia, and his purpose, strengthening all the disciples. So if you get anything from the book of Acts, it's probably the fact that I have overemphasized, Paul keeps going to the places he planted churches and teaching them. Here's just another example when he does this. If I counted right, this is the fourth time he's been to Galatia and Phrygia. Is that right? Third thing? Yes. Fourth time that he's been to Phrygia on three missionary journeys. Right? Fourth time. And then we go to verse 24 through 28. And I should be done for the night unless anybody has anything. And it says this in verse 24. And a certain Jew named Apollos, born of Alexandria, an eloquent man, and mighty in the scriptures. Remember, the scriptures right here are the Old Testament. He was a Jew, so he knew the Old Testament really well. Came to Ephesus. This man was instructed in the way of the Lord. And being fervent in the spirit, so he was a passionate man. So he's a Jew. He knows the scriptures really well. And he's very passionate. Now, for some reason, I think people today think somebody who has a lot of enthusiasm and energy and passion and zeal can't also know the scriptures well. Exhibit A, he knows the scriptures well, and he's super passionate about, fervent in spirit. He spake and taught diligently the things of the Lord, knowing only the baptism of John. I infer from this, and this is me completely, that he is a convert pre-day of Pentecost. What it seems like. Remember, the Great Commission is given in Acts 28. Baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They're baptized in the book of Acts and all through up to this point. So this is me reading into it, but it seems like it makes sense. He only knew the baptism of John, so it makes you wonder if this is what happened. He goes back for one of the feasts during the life of Jesus. Maybe even before that. When John the Baptist is baptizing, so this is very beginning of Jesus' ministry. Maybe he was one in Matthew 3 that came forth, got baptized there. That's all he knows about is the baptism of John. Then, if he goes back to Ephesus in Asia Minor, it's me reading into it, but you can come to your own conclusion there. And it says in verse 26, and he began to speak boldly in the synagogue. So I don't know if we want to count this or not, but this is Apollos now going to the synagogue. So from our vantage point, God is still placing emphasis on the synagogue. It's not Paul, it's Apollos here. Whom, when Aquila and Priscilla had heard, they took him unto them and expounded unto him the way of God more perfectly. So, evidently, he has some deficiency in his theology. He doesn't try to. He's just not been instructed yet. So I want to point out who took him aside. Both of them. I want to emphasize that, ladies. Both of them took him aside and taught them. Aquila and Priscilla, everywhere in the scriptures, are together. Every single time they're mentioned together. She is teaching Apollos. That's the only conclusion you can come from reading this text. She is helping to teach Apollos the way of the Lord more perfectly. So, a lot I could say about that, but I will put an onus and a pressure on ladies. You need to learn your Bible. You need to. There are some people that you will be able to help that perhaps your husband, your pastor, a male will not be able to. And it's not a competition. Maybe it's jointly. You can work together to help instruct. That's what happens here. And praise God, Apollos is humble enough to listen, to realize I must have some deficiencies. So, the way I've got it visualized in my mind, based upon some of the facts of the text, Apollos is evidently a slightly younger man. He's fervent in spirit, but he's old enough to go back to the baptism of John and to be mighty in the scriptures. So he's probably taught from a young age as a Jew, but he's a younger man, maybe 30, 35. I don't know how old he is. He's a younger man. He's got the ability. He's very eloquent. Says that. He's preaching with all this passion and fire. But he's not fully informed. And so these two believers who have been expelled from Rome have been with Paul now for a couple years, listening to him preach and teach. They themselves have their own faith and understanding. After one of his sermons, they come and say, "Hey, Apollos, a lot of what you're saying is great, but there's more. There's more than what you understand. Why don't you come stay with us for a while?" Now, I love the fluidity of this. I love that I love the way that this is happening. And to me, this is flies in the face of the pride that I think we as Americans can have sometime, that like we have to have it all together and know everything. That's not the case here. And it shouldn't be the case with us. Somebody comes to, after a sermon, after a Sunday school lesson you teach, after a testimony you give, say, "Hey, I want you to think about this. What are you going to do?" Well, if you're about you, you'll get offended, defensive, whatever. If you're about the purity of the gospel, glorifying God and helping others, you'll take self right out of it. "I don't care about me. Am I preaching an incomplete or tainted message to people? I don't want to do that." A number of people I've respected in the past, I've asked this question: "Can you give me any advice about my preaching? Is there something I'm doing that's causing a stumbling block when I preach? A way that I deliver it? Something that I'm saying? Even a mannerism? Because I don't want to." And some people have told me the truth. And it hurts for a few moments. But if you correct it and you realize this isn't about me, this is about... Now, on the conversely, I've had people say, "You know, you're the best thing since sliced bread." And I've, in my mind at that moment, thought, "I'll never come to you again. That's not what I'm looking for." I know that's not true. And that's not false humility. It's not true. I want to be as effective as I can, whether it's teaching my kids as a father, whether it's teaching a church, whether it's whatever. And if there's something that can be done to refine that, both in content or delivery or whatever. We want to be the best we can at it. Now, if you're like me, so maybe some of your Sunday school teachers here, and if I said to you this Sunday, I want to come sit in your class and just listen to you teach, you'd probably get real nervous, wouldn't you? You're probably like, he's going to criticize me and all these things. And I've felt the same way when I see Brother Moran walk in the back door on a Sunday morning. I'm like, oh, this is a bad Sunday. And come. I hope he's gracious, right? And there have been some. I'm not really like that with Brother Moran anymore. He's very gracious, probably too gracious, right? But where you do kind of tense up a little bit. And again, that's self-oriented. Don't we want the opposite? Don't we want people to see the gospel and the truth? And if there's something I can do to get more of me out of the way and Christ and the truth seen more clearly, please help me. It's important. Paulus is a tremendous example where this husband and this wife take him aside for a while and teach him the Word of God more perfectly. And then what we're going to learn here soon is that he becomes mature enough to be Paul's next traveling companion. Would that have been the case if they hadn't taken... I don't know. We don't know. Obviously, they're doing an important work. That's one of the reasons why they were taken from Corinth to Ephesus, weren't allowed to go any further, because God wanted them to help ready this man. Maybe that was one of the big reasons why Claudius expelled them in the first place. We don't know what God's purposes are. What we do know is that later, Apollos is going to have a tremendous effect at the church at Corinth, where they just came from. Because if we go back and we read Corinthians, if you remember, there comes a point where Paul uses himself and Apollos as an example. So what's going to happen right here in Acts 18? He's taught the way more perfectly. And then it says in verse 27, "And when he was disposed to pass into Achaia, the brethren wrote, exhorting the disciples to receive him, who, when he was come, helped them much which had believed through grace." So he goes back to Achaia, which is where Corinth is at, and given the fact that he's talked about in the book of Corinthians, it seems like here he goes back to Corinth. Apollos goes back to Corinth. He begins to teach and preach to these people in Corinth. Now, on Paul's third journey, when he gets back to Ephesus, here in just a chapter, he's going to write to the Corinthians. And he's going to tell them, there are men there that are making you followers of a man. And he says, figuratively, he's not talking, they weren't worshiping him and Apollos, but he used Apollos and Paul figuratively. He said, some will boast about being of Apollos, and some will boast of being of Paul. Well, that wasn't really the case. They were boasting of being of these other men. He's using Apollos because they're acquainted with him. This shouldn't be. And then he uses the famous analogy that you've heard. Paul planted, Apollos watered. We're reading right now Apollos watering. You see the direct connection he's making? Paul was just in Corinth, and what did he do? He planted. They became believers then. He left, goes to Ephesus, Aquila and Priscilla teach Apollos, Apollos goes back to Corinth, and what does he do? He teaches and he waters. And so Paul wasn't just using some haphazard analogy saying, well, Paul planted, Apollos watered. No, literally, Paul planted, Apollos watered. But he's trying to say, these preachers that are there now, that are trying to get followers, they don't realize that even though I planted, Apollos watered, God gave the increase. The reason you're saved is because of God. And that is the same with those leaders that you have now seeking the preeminence and for you to follow them. God gives the increase on those things. Again, we see why Paul is using this language in Corinthians, because that's how it all unfolded for the Corinthians. Somebody else have a comment or a thought, a question you want to ask? We'll look one more place here. See if I can find it here. If you'll turn to 1 Corinthians 16. We've already been here once, but I want to look at a non-Aquila Priscilla reference. So we asked you to look at verse 19 earlier. And it says this. Paul's writing in 1 Corinthians. He's in verse 8. It tells us where he's at. But I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost. So I'm going to stay here at Ephesus until Pentecost, that big feast. For a great door and effectual is opened unto me, and there are many adversaries. So we'll learn about that here in a little bit. Now if Timotheus come, see that he may be with you without fear, for he worketh the work of the Lord, as I also do. So in this current place in Acts 18, Timothy and Silas are with Paul. Remember, they're traveling companions. So now before he comes there a second time, he says, I can't come. I'm going to see Timothy unto you. Receive him well. Listen to what he has to say. He's a worker of the Lord. And then it says, let no man therefore despise him, but conduct him forth in peace, that he may come unto me, for I look for him with the brethren. So I think the reason why he's telling them this is because Timothy's young. They're more likely to not receive a young man who's coming, especially after Paul in this letter has just got them ticked off. He said a lot of harsh things, and then he's sending a young man to come and help sort things out. He said, don't make him come in fear, right? Receive him. He's doing the work of the Lord. It seems likely that that is what's happening, but again, that's my conjecture. You have to sort that out for yourself. Verse 12, as touching our brother Apollos, so Apollos has already been there once. He's not there in this point in 1 Corinthians. I greatly desired him to come unto you with the brethren, but his will was not at all to come at this time, but he will come when he shall have convenient time. So he came there the first time. He said, listen, right now I just can't. For whatever the reason was, something's holding me up. But he did tell us, as soon as he's done doing what he's doing, he'll come and join him. That'll become more significant here in a couple weeks when Apollos joins Paul on some trips. And then here's Apollos' message, and then I'm done. Very last verse. For he mightily convinced the Jews, and that publicly, showing by the scriptures that Jesus was the Messiah. He was the Christ. So now we're seeing a clear theme emerge of what they are preaching directly to the Jews. They're trying to convince everybody that Jesus is the Messiah. And Apollos is doing that publicly. Now, we don't really do that anymore, and I think it's a detriment. It certainly would be a scary thing. I don't know if you've ever listened to any cassette tapes of debates when there used to be, even in this area, public debates where you would go to a facility and there would be two different religions gather, and people would say, well, what's the point of that? Well, it's the same point that Paul and Timothy and Silas and Apollos, they did it. And the reason is, if I can have a group of 200 people and 100 of them already know the truth, but 100 of them don't, and I can contend for the faith with somebody, it's a wonderful opportunity. Now, again, those things can devolve into name-calling and ad hominem attacks, but they don't always. They can be very fruitful things. And so, anybody got comments about Paul's time in Corinth or Ephesus? We're back in Antioch. And so where we'll leave Paul at the end of Acts 18, he is now in Galatia. He is traveling for the fourth time to all these churches, reestablishing, strengthening them in the faith. And then we're going to come into Acts 19.